Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
And welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
What up, Joshua?
I feel like I haven't chatted with you in a while, but that's not true. We just chatted last week.
No, that is not true. We do text. We still text.
That's true. That's true. You know, I don't know.
I love sending you a good morning text.
Yeah, it's nice. It was nice, you know. And I'm getting to this weird place in my life where, like, no matter if it's the weekend or weekday, I'm still getting up at 6 or 7 in the morning, you know. Like, I just get up and just do things, you know. I'm accomplishing more before 10 a.m. than I ever have in my entire life. It's just scary. It's just, you know, I don't know.
Like, your body thinks, your body's like, sleeping in is now 6, 7.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm getting up when I would usually get up to get ready for work. And, you know, I mean, part of that is because, like, there's nothing else to do but go to bed at night. You know, it's not like I'm at any concerts. I'm not going to any shows or movies or just hangouts. You know, we're just, and now that's, you know, going to get even harder to do as we enter the winter and, you know, COVID continues to rage and meets up with our lady flu and makes the world a dangerous place, even more dangerous to step outside of. So it's like, you know, it gets to be 8 o'clock at night and I'm just like, man, let's get to bed, you know?
Is that your drag name, Lady Flu?
Our Lady of the Influenza.
Hi, Lady Influenza.
Yeah, so I don't know. So, yeah, anyways, so my point is my life is boring right now, but as many of our lives are boring, so I'm getting up and having tea and reading early in the morning. Anyways, how are you? How was your week?
It's okay.
All right.
Just, you know, waiting for the new lockdown. I was just like, I mean, like, here's how I feel about it. We're in California, right? So if we do go to like official, like another like lockdown type of lockdown, if like anybody's lives felt like feel completely impacted by that, then maybe they're the problem. Well, you know, we're in the most restrictive tier our county is
right
now.
Well, yeah, that was kind of the weird thing where it's like, oh, we're going to have to go into another lockdown. I'm like, we left one? But, I mean, it's everybody else is acting that way. You know, everybody else, you know, yeah. Or not everybody, but plenty of people are going about their business. Now, our restrictive tier or whatever was supposed to take effect Saturday at midnight, correct?
But I believe so, yes.
But it hasn't. Jeffrey went out to, you know, gather sundries, and he said it was busy as ever. Nobody even checking. So I just don't think we're taking it very seriously. And I mean, obviously we're not taking it very seriously. And it's, I don't know. I don't know what to think. Cause part of me is like, listen, people are just going to do whatever they want to do. You might as well just let everything be normal, you know, and people are going to get sick and they're going to, you know, just like anything else, like with the flu or whatnot, they're going to catch it. And the, you know, conditions will be what they are, you know, for that particular person. You know, or they have to find a way to really restrict and really force people to stay locked down. You know, I just don't know. I'm caught in this weird situation where I'm like, I don't want people to get sick and die, as we've talked about before, obviously. But it seems like people are hellbent on getting sick and dying. So I don't know. It's just so strange. It's like people just are like, eh, fuck it. You know,
yeah, I don't understand how.
Home, but hey, I'm partying maskless and, you know, having a giant orgy, and the state can go fuck itself.
Well, I don't understand how people
COVID, can think they shouldn't be so weak.
like, I don't understand how people can say, like, sorry. Okay.
I've not been doing that. I'm staying home. I'm going to work or I'm at home. I mean, I have been doing my best. So sorry, I'm not trying to be flippant. Anyways, go ahead, Joe.
I don't understand how people can say that, like, oh, this is the perfect time to go, like, meet a friend and do something, you know, let's go and sit outside, like, let's go to some establishment when it's like, yeah, 15-20% of infection is coming from, like, restaurants. Right. It's coming from those things. And I'm just like, okay, well, you know, I literally haven't seen some people since, you know, before March, like before March. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and that's like okay with me because there's different ways for people to connect. It is not the same, but we're not living in ordinary time. We're living in extraordinary times. So until we can approach more, until we can go to more safe things, it's just like, I'm completely okay with being like, well, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Sorry, not going to do that. Don't feel comfortable doing that. Nope.
That is true.
I one of my friends posted like pictures or was tagged in pictures of like, it looked like a Friendsgiving and she lives in Washington. And I'm like, oh my God, there are like 10 people that are going to die from this because of their like Friendsgiving and the just, you know, beautiful white faces, all happy, smiling. It is like the Decameron, you know? Yeah, no mask. No one was wearing a mask. It's like, oh my God, all inside. And I'm like, oh no. Well, I don't know if I'm going to feel sorry, but I mean, I will on a human level. Yes, I feel sorry for you. But at the same time, it's like, well, what did you expect?
So. Yeah, I see that a little bit with my family because some of them are posting that they have COVID or that they've been fighting, you know, and it's like, well, that sucks, but you were posting that it's all fake and a hoax or that you weren't going to wear a mask and you weren't going to do anything different. And now you're, you know, I can't, I've had this for 10 days now, for 2 weeks now. And it's like, yeah. It's an illness that scientists and doctors have been talking about, but what do they fucking know? You know, I got a sixth grade education, so I certainly know more than a scientist. Not to be elitist about academics, but when it comes to some of my family members, I can't help it but be like, really? You're criticizing doctors and science as creating this whole hoax worldwide. Really, these few scientists got together with all the countries of the world and said, "Hey, let's all make up this sickness so that Donald Trump can win the presidency, yes, or lose the presidency, or whatever their conspiracy is now." Because I'm very confused by the whole thing about how the creating this pandemic is helping the Democrats, but whatever, or hurting them, or whatever. I don't know. QAnon, lizard people,
so adrenochrome. I'm going to be completely honest now. I have another confession for you. when you started talking about QAnon a couple episodes ago, I had no idea what that shit was. I was like, oh, no, is this like a message board, like a 4chan? Like, I didn't know that it was like this big, the conspiracy of it. And I was like, what is he talking about? Why is he talking about pedophilia?
Yeah. And I don't even think they freaking know. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this bizarre collection of various conspiracies, like Pizzagate and the adrenochrome thing, and then some of the lizard people kind of get involved in it, or not, maybe, Satanists in the Democratic Party, you know, the Hollywood child sex trafficking Satanists. I mean, it's all this, you know, I don't know. It's hard to get to pin down exactly because I really don't think that the people who are participating in it even have a very clear idea of what it is, you know. But all I know is that it is all working to help or maybe hurt Donald Trump. I don't know. That's the again. It's nuts. I mean, so One of our dear listeners is going to be like, you don't know what you're talking about, QAnon, and they're going to write to us and tell me all about it and maybe clarify some of my confusion, which I would welcome.
Have you watched Sarah Cooper, Everything's Fine on Netflix?
No, I've been wanting to, but I just haven't found the time, I guess. That's really the end of it. I would like to watch it, though. It was good. You saw it?
I liked it, and mainly I want you to watch it just for the QAnon Home Shopping Channel sketch that stars Aubrey Plaza.
Okay, I'm here for that already. That all sounds wonderful.
So I was like, this is completely up Joshua's alley.
Have you done research now that, since the topic was introduced to you?
I'm afraid to, because I don't want my cookies and my caches and my I don't want the data trail to like it's just like if I go say what is QAnon and then all of a sudden, you know, does that mean I'm in it? If I Google it, am I automatically in it now?
May show up, but nobody's shown up and asked me any questions yet, and I'm sure my browser searches have got to be concerning if you don't know me, and possibly even if you do know me, they're concerning. I do sometimes wonder about that when I'm like looking for certain things, especially related to horror, you know. So it was like, we're going to, you know, like our satanic panic. It's like child sex trafficking sacrifice. Like I'm looking for, you know, these cases and these stories and, you know, and then it's like, I was just watching that.
The people at JSTOR are like, what the hell is this guy looking for?
Exactly. Yeah. But that Dennis Nielsen, I watched Dez, the 3-part miniseries starring David Tennant playing Nielsen, who was a serial killer. You know, so then I'm like looking up his stuff and like crime scene photos. I'm just like, Lord knows, whatever, whoever is watching my, you know, if they were going to frame me for like, if I don't know, for whatever reason, like they would have plenty of evidence.
Yeah, there would not be. It'd be just like, you on this day, you Googled, you know, child murder crematorium. And like,
exactly.
Not. And then he was like,
well, that was one of them, because that actually was a real search. I know it totally, because they said that these Satanists had a traveling crematorium, which I think in this time frame would have been nearly impossible to have such a thing. But that was a search.
I just picked three random words.
No, but it's true. They like with the whole satanic panic thing, that they had a traveling crematorium to burn these thousands of bodies of missing people in that were not missing, but whatever, you know, hysteria works in mysterious ways. But yeah, no, if Jeffrey ever just wanted to like vanish off the face of the earth and run away and just, you know, blame me for murdering him, they probably would happen. You know, they could probably look and say, hey man,
yeah,
we're pretty sure you did something here.
He's gonna double jeopardy you. He's gonna Gone Girl you.
Exactly. Precisely. He could do it. And I probably would take the fall for it.
No, he'll be Invisible Man you.
Ooh, sick fuck. I'm going to Invisible Man him first. Anyway, so, God, besides all this, man, life is just a bizarre nightmare. The Crown is back. Speaking
of nightmares,
No, we watched the first three episodes this morning, though, and then took a break because I had to rewatch the movie that we're going to talk about in the second half. I had to watch it again, but we'll talk about that when we talk about the film. But yeah, we watched a couple episodes this morning. Have you watched it?
No, but I want to go back and rewatch some episodes from the last season.
I've been doing that over the last couple weeks, watching my favorite episodes from the whole series.
Okay. What are your favorites? This is a Crown Recap podcast now.
The Crown. We call it The Crown.
The Crown.
It's about a wee village.
For every Margaret, there's a Lilibet.
Exactly. So I like the in the first season, I like the episode where she finds out that she's going to be queen, because that's very interesting when they're in
colonial Africa.
Exactly. I think it's interesting, like, the way they portray that. I like the episode where she realizes she's stupid.
What episode is that?
It's like something in Ciencia something, but basically she Elizabeth realizes that she's had no real education, you know, and her mother's like, well, we gave you the education any girl should have, which is, it's nothing. She knows how to make tea. Or whatever it is that they feel is good enough for a girl.
I like the episode. That's good. I like that.
No, but that is the episode. She just suddenly realizes she doesn't know where anything is. She doesn't know what anybody's talking about. She's the queen, and she's got to go and hang out with these men who all have these, you know, high educations, you know, and she's just like, I don't know what anybody's talking about. So unless we talk about horses, then, you know, I can't, you know, and she's supposed to be leading this, you know, country or whatever it is the queen is supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, so I like that episode a lot where she like hires the tutor and she tries to learn, you know, about, you know, the world and how it works. You know, I like episodes like that. For a couple reasons. One, it really pisses me off, because when you're like that wealthy and have that kind of access and, you know, entree or whatever to the world, you know, they could go anywhere they want in the world practically at any time, you know, if they wanted to get access to any museum, any college, library, any, you know, I mean, especially in that time frame, you know, in the 60s, you know, and in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, it's like they had such power and they just sat around like not at all being impressed by the artwork they were surrounded by, the history that they were surrounded by, not at all interested in it. You know, there's that whole episode where the Kennedys visit, and there's the whole thing about Jackie Kennedy, you know, talking about just how boring they all are, and basically that they're, you know, kind of stupid, you know, that they don't seem intelligent or curious about the world around them, you know? And so I just find those episodes interesting that highlight that, because you sit here going, it's the fucking Queen of England, you know? And it's like, they do seem kind of stupid. You know, I mean, they just live this very insulated life, and it does seem, you know, I mean, obviously they have other concerns and other things that they're doing that, you know, the rest of us mere mortals, peasantry, could not understand, I'm sure. But, you know, it's just, I like episodes that highlight that. And there's one, the artwork one, where the guy turns out to be the Russian mole or whatever. That episode's really interesting. You know, I like the one with the Aberfan, you know, that tragedy. I think that's a good one, because it...
The,
you know,
one in Wales?
Yeah, because that demonstrates, you know, the real... you know, it that connected to a very real world situation, you know, because the Crown, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it is sort of a fictionalization of, you know, a dramatization of real events.
Of history, yeah.
You know, so I like when they take ones that were kind of, you know, were big on a big, big scale and weren't just about the royal family or just about, you know.
I like, yeah, her reaction to it and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I like, so those are the ones I like to watch. Oh, and Margaretology. I love anything with Helena Bonham Carter. So Bonham Carter. I can't even say her name right. Anyways, what about you?
I like the one about climate change, The Fog.
Yeah.
The Fog that killed people.
Yeah.
I do love a John Lithgow as Winston Churchill.
Yeah, it was great. It was a really good choice.
And I think from this last season, I really enjoyed Charles Goes to Wales.
Interesting.
Also, because I love that that actor is just, you know, yummy and, you know, very, 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 very good actor. So,
yeah. Yeah. So far I'm enjoying the new season. I like seeing Gillian Anderson come in as Margaret Thatcher.
Is she there from the beginning?
Yeah, yeah. The very first episode is about her inauguration. I don't know what you call it, like installation as the prime minister. And so like her first meeting with the queen and then, you know, that kind of thing.
I invite you to form a government in my name. I love
exactly.
I all that stuff. I think I love The Crown because it reminds me of Game of Thrones. Like, there's all these people and these different names.
Lots of intrigue.
Lots of intrigue. And that's one of my favorite things about like shows with many characters, that you get to learn who the different characters are. Like, I love a good Tommy Lasseter's like droll, very droll commentary on things. And, you know, Colonel Adeen, a little Michael Adeen as well. Little Martin Charteris. I just love those guys. Like, those are the guys that I would actually like. This would be a fun job to have. To be your private secretary. Private secretary.
Right. Secretary.
Secretary. I watched, so on Veterans Day we were off and I spent the whole day and I watched from start to finish season 2 of The Politician.
Oh.
And
had you watched it before though? This was like a second rewatch?
No, this is my first time. I had been saving it. Like, I just wasn't really in the right place to watch anything about politics in fictional version. And I mean, like, yeah, The Politician's not even really about politics. So, but yeah, it was exactly what I thought it was going to be. It is very fun and campy, and they need to find a way to bring back Judith Light and Bette Midler, because I think those two really save the series.
Oh, yeah, that's the only reason I really watched it, because I didn't even finish the first season. I went back and watched the first episode that Judith Light was in. I guess she was in, like, the final episode or something of the first season. Mm-hmm. And then I watched the whole of the second season. And, I mean, I don't think you really have to watch the first season to enjoy it. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, you don't need to at all. It's such a departure. And there really is
its own story.
Yeah, it has its own story, like, for sure.
I just like seeing, you know, Bette Midler playing that kind of character. I thought it was a lot of fun. So I'm glad that you got to catch up and finally watch it, because it's so odd that I watched it and you didn't.
I know. Yeah. Very I fell out odd the things are happening.
Season. Yeah, I watched the first couple episodes and then I just didn't watch any more of it. I also, again, and I said this, I think we talked about me watching this already on the show, but I really don't like that lead guy. I just don't like him, you know, and not the character. I just don't like him. I don't know, you know, it's just a weird thing.
Just as a person?
I don't know. He just gives me a weird vibe. I don't know. He just has a face. Whatever. Anyways, he's obviously talented, you know. All of that, but
yes,
you know, it's kind of the same thing with listening. Who sang? He was the one who sang River.
Yes, at River's funeral.
It was awful. It was just so painful. I just, you know, I did see that, and I think that's where I stopped watching the show. I was just very turned off by it. But anyways, I did rejoin because I like Bette Midler and Judith Light, and that was enough for me to stick it out and watch that whole the second season just to watch Bette Midler be. The way she was on that show. Yeah. I mean, it was great.
The Hadassah Gold, which is just Hadassah. The best.
Okay, so we've been talking for like 20 minutes and no, nothing to do with a horror. Well, I mean, some horror, existential horror. Mm-hmm. We got Freaky, came out on the 13th, Blumhouse. Not had a chance to watch it yet. I guess it'll be out for video on demand on the 30th. So stay tuned, kids. We're going to watch and discuss that. You know, I guess when I think about it, I didn't really watch a lot of horror this week. I was getting caught up on The Crown and The Croon.
The crew
are not getting caught up. Like I said, rewatching. Gosh, there was something else I had restarted to watch, and I don't remember what it was. Ugh, well, that's too bad. Anyways, Ryan Murphy dropping American Horror Story and American Horror Stories hints and posters. So I'm curious what they're going to do. Did you see Sarah Paulson's Linda Tripp photograph?
No.
Yeah, she's going to be playing Linda Tripp in American Crime Story Impeachment. So she revealed her look and that they had started principal photography. It'll be interesting to see actually her acting in it. But in the photo, I mean, you kind of have to like look at it to find Sarah's face in there. You know, they did a good job of making her, you know, making her up as Linda. I'm very curious how that show will play out, you know, just because we...
Yes.
I firmly remember that scandal and it kind of being a big discussion.
I'm really excited for Beanie Feldstein to be Monica.
I was showing that to Jeffrey today. We were looking at pictures of the different actors that have been cast and thinking about how they're going to play the different people.
She's best friends with the twink you don't like. She's best friends with Ben Platt.
Oh, well, there we go.
They went to high school together.
Oh, of course they did. That's adorable. I don't know. Again, I didn't. I really didn't watch a ton this week. Just the film that we're talking about. Well, I did watch another movie, but that's going to be the subject of our next episode. So I don't want to talk too much about that either. So I did watch some stuff, but for the show.
Yeah.
Wasn't really, I didn't watch any fun horror stuff.
Yeah, well, we're coming off of, I mean, I'm not trying to apologize or like explain away why, but it's like, you know, we are coming off of like Halloween and we're going into the lighter Christmas holiday with Thanksgiving and all of that stuff. So
yes, Thanksgiving is a Christmas holiday.
I mean, this year it is because I'm just like, I'm playing Christmas music at work. I'm just telling people
I know people have just moved on. Yeah.
Let's do
Christmas.
Exactly. And given all of the everything we already know about the problematic nature of Thanksgiving in general, it's like, let's just move on to Christmas,
right? Because problematic capitalism.
Exactly. Because that's something that we can all. Yeah, there's a very nice secular component.
True. I did order some things. I ordered a couple of black Santa hats and some scary Christmas sweaters. So I'm starting to prepare. I've ordered a few other things because my brother and his wife are going to come visit with their child, their chilled. And so I ordered I ordered some things for him so he can be scary Christmas appropriate, and I'm going to order some things for them. And so at least for one day, because she's a super Christmas fan, you know, she loves the Hallmark Channel and all the movies. She watches all of them. She's like Christmas freak, like I am Halloween freak. So,
the light in the dark.
One day. You know, because they're coming after the holidays, so they actually arrive on the 26th. So they'll do their whole fancy family Christmas the way they want to do it, and then they're going to come here and do it the way that we do it. And it's gonna be fun. And so I'm getting them some different, scary Christmas or, outfits and things. It's going to be fun. So... And they're not going to be able to say no because their other presents are going to be even better. So it's like, you have to wear this or I'm not giving you anything else. but it'll be fun. And we'll watch. I'm not sure. I need to actually find out from my brother what movies the kid has seen. Although he's so young that it probably doesn't really matter. But, you know, I do want to show like Nightmare Before Christmas and things like that to him. So it's not going to be too horror. We're not going to do The Exorcist.
Oh, why not?
Well, I mean, if he wakes up early before they do and he comes and wanders out, maybe. No, I'm kidding. plans are starting to firm up. We have some plans in the works for our Christmas series this December. So I'm very excited about some of those plans and some of the cool stuff we're going to be doing. So stay tuned as always, dear listener. Anything else, Joe, before we transition?
Speaking of Christmas movies, everyone should definitely watch The Christmas Bow on Hallmark Holiday and Mysteries or whatever it's called.
Yeah. What was it? Mysteries and something.
Mysteries and, you know, cheer and like I'll murder and yeah.
Because our friend was in it. Our friend Jill, whose podcast we were on recently, A Favor for Freddy. Mm-hmm. She invited us on to discuss Halloween, and that was a lot of fun. So I'll link the Christmas Bow film information below and the information to her podcast, because that was actually a really fun conversation, you know, to have with her and with you, yeah. Joe, as always, as every conversation is. So, all right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back to discuss the smudging.
I just want to apologize. I'm sorry to everyone. I was very naive and very stupid, and I shouldn't have put other people in danger. I am so sorry for everything that has happened, because in spite of what Joshua says, it's now all my fault. I insisted our listeners subscribe to Fright School on Apple Podcasts. I insisted they leave us reviews. I insisted that they give us a 5-star rating. And it's all because of me that we're here now and we're being hunted. I love you, Mom and Dad. I am so sorry. I only wanted to make good content for our listeners. I'm so scared. I'm going to die out here. Joshua, is that you?
All right, welcome back. So today's episode, we are discussing 2016's The Smudging, which is about a paranormal research group, the Night Stalkers, are brought in to investigate an aggressive supernatural entity at a Native American cultural center in Chicago, Illinois. Written and directed and acted in by Mike J. Marin. We decided this year we wanted to, the reason we're doing this movie and then the film that'll be the subject of our next episode is that we kind of wanted to look at some films that were written and created by, you know, indigenous / Native American people working in the horror genre. And so The Smudging has been one of the movies that's kind of been floating on the outside of our, you know, the periphery of our show for a while, you know, that we knew we wanted to talk about it and to do it. So this felt like the perfect time to do that. So let's start, Joe, with your thoughts.
It definitely had, like, it had the scary documentary vibes that, you know, of the Blair Witch. Like, it's very much in the tradition of Blair Witch, yeah, of a movie that I haven't seen, Paranormal Activity, of Quarantine for a little bit, of Wreck. And that was all really interesting. I mean, it's what I think I love the most about it is the fact that, like, we're using, they're using, like, indigenous practices as a way to combat evil. Like, even there's like a scene where one of the, like, tech guys hands the other guy, like, a little crucifix, and that really does nothing, but, like, it's the indigenous practices. So I like that that's being, I like that we're having a film that's addressing that. That's a film that's like, okay, well, these people have been, you know, this entity has been here for, you know, since before humankind. So it's like we're, and there's that kind of, you know, relation to it. But yeah, I mean, overall, I don't think I'll watch it again, but I did appreciate what it's saying and, like, where what it potentially could inspire.
Yeah, this is watching the movie made me glad that we, at the end of the day, are not a review podcast. I'm not here to discuss whether movies are good or bad, typically on the show, because I do make a lot of the choices. I choose films that I like and that I enjoy watching and that I think have, you know, academic or cultural discussions happening them in them. So this film, again, I think there's a lot to discuss, you know, within mm-hmm. it. There's some history that I think people should know about it, and sort of what led to its creation. It does have the quality of like a student film.
Mm-hmm.
I think you had texted me that, and I felt like that was very true. You know, and again, that goes back to questions of, you know, who gets to make films, who gets money to make films, you know, what contribution. And so I agree. I think that while, you know, surface wise, I didn't think this was a great movie. In fact, that's why I had to watch it again, because I kept finding myself distracted by other things. I couldn't focus on the movie, you know, which is, I mean, it just, there are technical issues within it that just make it a difficult film to watch.
Yeah.
You know, but there's,
yeah. Yeah. There's something to be said about like being, having a like technically proficient film, like in order to, if you have a film that is like you, it's well made in terms of, you know, the technical aspects of it, it doesn't take away from the story. Like those are the things that will like make your story sing through. And it's not like, you know, like The Love Witch or like other, like some like gay movies where it's like, it's campy. So like the fact that it's poorly made is part of it. You know, that's not this. This was definitely, it definitely had that sense. And I think what was, you know, the last technical thing that I'll talk about, because I found this as the main struggle for me, was the fact that, like, are we supposed to believe that this is all shot from, like, the first person? Mm-hmm. Because there were times where it's like, okay, the camera, like, there was a spirit that passed by when Danny Boy's in the hallway that first time that's doing kind of, like, the grudge crawl. And it's like, okay, are we supposed to believe that, like, the camera is is part of their team and just didn't say anything? Or, you know, like, what was kind of the point of that? Because it looked like a regular, like, not there cameraman. So,
yeah, that did push the belief a lot of times where, you know, unlike, you know, the things that work in the Blair Witch Project is that, you know, all the cameras are cameras that they're holding or carrying and they're talking to the cameraman or they're using. And this did, it did feel like they had this other omniscient camera happening while mm-hmm. trying to be seen as a found footage film type thing or a documentary film. But there were definitely times there was another camera because it was confusing to me at first when they were walking at the very, very beginning where they go to interview the first woman that quit, you know, and mm-hmm. had left the Native America Cultural Center after being pushed by, you know, a multi-handed entity of some sort. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm here with the cameraman, but he was clearly talking about the guy next to him and not the camera walking in front of them filming. And that really, it threw me. So that's again why I had to watch the movie over, because there were details I missed or things that just, I think, were not clear. You know, and again, they, according to like the trivia pages I found for this, you know, they made this with like, you know, a little over $3,000, a lot of that donated, through GoFundMe. They had, you know, this is like a group of people that kind of, I feel like know each other or, you know, kind of were working together. Some of them worked at this Native American Cultural Center, and so they got to use it on Friday nights and all day Saturdays to film the film. The director, I think, worked there as some sort of youth mentor. The woman who plays his sister, who coincidentally, they have the same real name or the same last name, real last name in real life, quote unquote. But they're not related, but they play brother and sister, Bad and Max in the film. I think she worked there as well. So, you know, I mean, this is definitely, again, because that student effort feel to it is because I think that it kind of was, you know, it kind of had that same energy. But again, you know, not to you know, review the film too much, but just to kind of lay context for, you know, discussing the movie, because I don't, you know, I don't want to say it was like some great film.
Yeah.
Again, I think it laid the foundation for films that we're going to talk about in our, in continuing discussions of Indigenous horror. And there's not a lot. There's not a ton of Indigenous horror out there yet, but it is growing. And, you know, we're starting to see that be evened out.
Yeah, it really comes down to, so what I'm kind of reminded of with this film is when Pose first came out, that first season of Pose, and I was talking with one of my friends and they were like, I don't like it. I don't think that they're particularly good performers.
Right.
And then I kind of countered with, well, I mean, they're trying to be authentic and honest about the stories that they're telling. Like these right. are, you know, these are women who have not only lived in this scene, but like, you know, live this life as Black trans women in, you know, in the big city. So you really kind of have to ask yourself, like, what are the, are we at what, what costs, and also like access to resources right. and all of those things. So like this film is very, this film, The Smudging, is just an example of like, if we could give these people, you know, if we could give the film crew the resources that they needed, what possibly could have been done. Cause I just kept thinking like, oh, this is like the first rough shot of like a movie that eventually will be adapted into some Blumhouse feature, found footage feature or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think, again, there are some good ideas here and there are some, history and some things to glean from it. So, you know, in reading like interviews with the director and all, the film, again, it concerns itself with a Native American cultural center. And if, dear listener, you're not aware, there was the Indian Relocation Act of 1956, which was this law that encouraged, or it was intended to encourage, American Indians, Native peoples, you know, the indigenous population that was here before
white European settlers,
before colonialism happened to them. You know, so it was created to encourage them to leave the reservations and their, you know, traditional homelands and to assimilate. You know, for a variety of reasons, obviously people go, well, this is, you know, for their own good, but really the United States did not want to continue to subsidize for Native peoples, and I think, quite frankly, they wanted the land as well, as urban expansion continued to grow, and so it was kind of a way to continue to shrink and to undermine the traditional lives of Native people and to further take away from them, and by trading in this idea that their lives would be better if they joined the modern world, quote unquote. Although plenty of, they were living, you know, perfectly fine lives without needing to live in the city, so to speak. So they, you know, basically kind of forced, I mean, again, it's hard to live in a culture of capitalism and all of that, to live outside of it. There's just a certain point where life is going to, you know, kind of outrun you. And I think that is sort of what happened here. So a lot of people were forced into the cities, into, you know, urban centers, and they were sort of, you know, their lives were pulled out from under them, their families, their communities, the people they knew. So these Native American cultural centers, urban centers popped up as a place to support Native people coming into the city, where they could find community, where they could find communion, where they could find people who shared their beliefs or shared their experiences. So as the director explains in some notes on, like, I guess the official movie page for The Smudging, his parents met on relocation in the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area in the 60s. Like many natives new to urban areas, they sought out other natives who were also unfamiliar with the areas and lifestyles. So the Native American community centers were established to be a lighthouse to congregate with other Native people. He grew up in the halls of Oakland, California's urban Indian center called the Intertribal Friendship House. And so he had spent years there, you know, in the area, and that they, I like this. He said they kind of had, they all had a similar feeling to them, this mixture of old world comfort and concrete familiarity. Also, they always smelled like pipe tobacco and sage, the medicines of our culture. You know, but he said at night, though, they were also very creepy. And, you know, it kind of gets a little, I would like to get some clarification, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe we should reach out to him and see if we can like get him to come actually on the show and chat about this. But, you know, these places, these cultural centers, you know, were sometimes, you know, they were like donated or dwelling, you know, they were places that had been something else. They were hospitals or prisons or, you know, they were some other building that served some other purpose that then they got re-skinned as these cultural centers. And so he said that a lot of times they just felt creepy at night, you know, if you were in there, if you were volunteering and maybe you were doing stuff at night or cleaning up. And so that he felt these creepy vibes. And that's kind of what led to him creating and writing this film, particularly about the one that he worked at. I guess he moved and somehow ended up in Chicago. And so that's where, you know, the smudging was shot on location there. From the halls of the Intertribal Friendship House to the floors of the American Indian Center of Chicago, I have collected, you know, these stories. And so grab your flashlights, huddle together in the dark, and I will tell you a story. So that is from his, like, official director's notes on the smudging. And so... So that's where these centers kind of come from. So they have, you know, for the last, you know, 50 plus years served as this sort of space. And, you know, by the way, the effect of that law really in the end had very devastating long-term effects. Relocated tribe members became isolated from their communities and they faced racial discrimination and segregation. Many, while promised, you know, this upward mobility of joining, you know, the United States, whatever you want to call it, cult, you know, they ended up with only low paying jobs with, you know, little advancement potential, suffered from lack of community support and the higher expenses typical for urban areas. And they couldn't even return to where they had come from because the reservations had been dissolved. You know, so it just kind of created this really, really, really terrible situation for Native people in the 60s and 70s, and that we obviously still see echoed today. So to return to the film, what I like and what I saw potential here is that in horror, and we've seen this with It, we've seen this with Pet Sematary, we've seen this with Poltergeist, you know, this idea of like ancient Indian burial grounds, you know, there's all like, is just this hard to avoid trope in a lot of horror. You know, so I kind of was excited about the ideas of, you know, a Native group, talking about a spirit that lives in this place outside of like, because there's a whole conversation, although again, it didn't make much sense. And this is where, you know, again, if they had somebody come in and maybe help with the script or rewrites, I'm not sure. I don't know what really what their process was, but the man they bring in, Robert, who's not a medicine man, but he's like...
He's a medicine warrior.
Right, medicine warrior. That's a good way. Yeah, that is how they describe him. I guess that's what we can say. You know, how he's like, you know, oh, this entity was here even before the Native peoples. The people that were here before the Native people worshipped him. And I'm like, wait, so who is that? Who, like, if the Native people... if there was somebody here before the Native people, then the Natives are not the Natives. You know, like those people are the Natives. So I was a little confused by some of that, what exactly the entity was. Definitely related to the Babadook, clearly.
Yes, I was like, is this Pissy Miles?
Right.
it was like, when he's like, you know, holding up the little cross and Pissy Miles is right there, I was half expecting, you know, the Babadook. the Babadook.
Right. Yeah. Get Bob shook.
When he's talking about like how the entity is, predates the native people, worshiped by the people who came before. I was kept thinking about It Chapter 2 Mike is talking about exactly that, like then this like supernatural intergalactic entity that the native people were fighting. And it's like, who are they though? I felt very similarly. I'm like, who are these people?
Yeah. So it got a little kind of confusing there. But again, like dealing with sort of this, so many tropes of horror, like I was saying, you know, it is about the Indian burial ground and, you know, America truly, read a little bit of this. This is from The Rise of Indigenous Horror, How a Fiction Genre is Confronting a Monstrous Reality. And this is by Alicia Elliott writing. Says, if the creators of Western horror believe indigenous genocide only belongs in the national consciousness as a horror trope, the infamous Indian burial ground, which for the record should be all of this continent, and that the people, often white, haunted by our ancestors' ghosts, are innocent victims, what do the descendants of those ghosts fear? What more is there to fear when you've already faced governments who have tried for centuries to wipe you out, who have used biological warfare and forced starvation to create an apocalypse for your people? So I was excited to watch this film, called The Smudging. And, you know, there's lots of things about, you know, obviously smudging has become sort of commonplace in our society, you know, like Gwyneth Paltrow's doing it on the cover of Goop, I'm sure, you know, it's kind of, you know, become its own sort of trope in movies, you know, when really it's a ceremony, a custom of Native American and other indigenous cultures that they use smudging as it calls on the spirits of sacred plants to drive away negative energies and restore balances. So I was like, okay, this is kind of cool. We're at like a Native American cultural center. You know, we have these characters who are Native. We have this history that we know of. And I thought that this would explore that a little bit more, you know, and maybe reckon with some of those tropes. So I was a little let down with the revelation of the monster and that it was something, you know, it kind of akin to It, you know, that it kind of always been here. And maybe that's why, maybe it needed a little bit of clarification because maybe that's what he meant. Maybe he just meant not our tribe, but another tribe was, you know, on this particular land rather than the natives before the natives as it comes across a little bit clumsily in the script. So that was one topic to kind of to look at in this movie, you know, sort of hoping that it would reconcile with like that poltergeist kind of thing and and like Pet Sematary. It did not do that. I thought it was kind of it was setting it up that it could have, but again, I think it's planting that conversation, you know, and that other films will do, and we'll talk about at the end what our next episode will be, because all of this is going to be a lot more applicable to that film. I think it's the better of these two films. I just wanted to bring that up, like the kind of the history of that and this this trope, because I thought I would deal with that a little bit more, and it really didn't. They talked a little bit about smudging as commercialization, you know, that it's become this sort of commonplace thing. And then they made sage grenades, which was a little...
I didn't know what to, I was like, sage grenades. Also, they were, I mean, in Chicago, a place that is known for a fire, they took these, you know, grenade, like these little bombs of flammable material, lit them up and threw them and then ran away. And I was yeah. And I'm just like, I don't know about this.
And then didn't even Robert use one after he like criticized that? He's like, sage is not, it's to bring in the light. It's not like a weapon. And then they have him like, yeah, using something similar. So that was also a little muddy. Again, it just was hard to track the, you know, these rules of the, of the thing.
I thought it was a little unsettling where, you know, oh, I'm just going to listen to someone being brutally murdered.
Yeah. Yeah. When they were, cause that's another part of the story that kind of resolves itself very quickly,
which like I didn't think was necessary. Like exactly what you said. And again, we're very dangerously flirting with being a review podcast right now. But the thing about it is that I felt like there could have been so much more, especially like after the opening cards where it's like, this is based on a true thing that happened. Like this is based on an actual experience. And so I'm like, okay, that would be really cool. But then you had like this whole thing with a serial killer and those like awful, disturbing pictures of buttons and all that stuff. And I was like, and you know what? Like, I kind of get it because that also reminded me of it. It's like the, you know, the thing on the surface when the deeper thing is the fact that, you know, Pennywise is this, you know, extraterrestrial supernatural entity.
Right. Influencing people.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm just like, I totally get where that was coming from. But at the same time, I didn't think it was necessary. And then to just kind of have like, you know, him listening to this snuff film and then we watch him react.
Yeah,
it was.
It was a strange diversion. I mean, and it kind of comes up with like his spirit is also there with the buttons, but it was just, yeah, again, it was just a little muddy. But, you know, again, I think trying to approach that with, you know, like the Amityville Horror, it's like, Ronald DeFeo had believed that the house, like, you know, the ancient Indian burial grounds, and that there was this spirit of an Indian, of a native person who was like influencing and encouraging him to murder people, you know, and to murder his family, I think was one of the delusions that he held. You know, before the family moves in, that's the story before the story. You know, so it's like kind of interesting to be like, you know, to kind of reckon with this idea that it's not the, you know, it's not the native people or the native spirits creating this situation. You know, they're not the ones walking these halls. It's this other entity that is forcing people to do bad things. You know, that is not indigenous. You know, spirit, I guess, is what they were trying to do. Again, I think there are a lot of good ideas here that just needed fleshing out and commitment. You know, I think that overall, that was the really hard thing with this movie, again, is that with the acting, the commitment to it. Like, either we're kind of like, is this funny or is it not funny? Or we like, is, you know, so again, I'm not necessarily recommending the film. as something that people need to see, but I think as a way, as an entrance into discussing, you know, horror created
Native by horror.
Indigenous artists, I think this is a good conversation because there are things to discuss. I like, you know, the Native history is, I mean, it has a very rich tradition of oral, of storytelling, of, you know, there are lots of creatures and lots of spirits and entities that could be played with and could be, you know, well suited for horror in the hands of indigenous artists and creators. You know, I think there's a lot there to explore, and this kind of starts to do that a little bit. I think again, if they made any money off of this or are able to, you know, to use it to raise more money and to, you know, write and create something that expands these ideas, could be really, really great. You know, but they would also need to kind of, I think the director would need to kind of step outside of it and not necessarily act in it. And then, of course, it got really weird. I don't know. I mean, I kind of felt awkward with the thing at the end where it was like, oh, the woman has to do it because, like, women create and they're the light. And that was very strange. And I think sometimes that's one of those things where it's like, obviously I don't deny like the power of women clearly, but you know, men create life too. And they're, you know, I don't know. That just felt very clumsy and weird.
Yeah.
There were things in this that felt very bro-y at times.
Yes.
You know, like some of the jokes or some of the things that they said to each other. I'm like, is that like an inside joke between these people in life? You know, or like we're just saying stuff to kind of, I don't know. It was just weird. It was a little bro. And that kind of whole moment there, I was just like, wait, okay, what? Not that it's not true. Not that, you know, people don't, you know, hold women in this sort of space. And again, it could have been, it just felt tacked on like at the end and just clumsy. I don't know. I did think it had some genuinely creepy moments though. When that girl came across the hall, that was creepy. When she like crawled across in the background and like there were some shadows and there were some tense moments. I mean, being in an empty building in the basement, of course, it's just going to be creepy.
I loved, Danny Boy. Hey dude, there's a little girl up here.
Right. Yeah.
And then, cause like, I would like to think that that's what I would be like if I was in that situation. They'd be like, hey guys, there's a little girl up here. Something's and then I think my favorite line of the whole thing was Danny Boy saying to the spirit, are you a ghost?
Yeah.
I loved, I was like, I'm kind of here for this. I did like the little misdirect of, Danny Boy jumping, but not jumping.
Right.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
But again, like there's I think that what this film does too, is that it does kind of pull in a little bit from the idea of like oral tradition. Mm-hmm. And because you don't have the like benefit of flashback scenes, right, or, you know, that setting that up, it is an elder for the most part, you know, telling you tradition, you're getting the bits and the stories. And I thought that that was something that was very effective.
Yeah.
One thing that I could definitely relate as also a person who comes from like, you know, an indigenous occupied colonized, you know, people by infected by imperialism and colonialism. I like the idea that like, I kind of related to a few things, like right in the beginning where, I forget who they're interviewing, but it says, you know, the spirits will come and take you if you answer them. So like if they're talking to you, don't talk back.
Right.
And I'm just like, oh, I love that, because even in my culture, we have like our own beliefs about like ancestors and spirits of the land. And then even like spirits, from the recently departed, like when I was, the year that I was born, a few months after I was born, my grandmother died. And there is a belief that, you know, you have to kind of, if you have a newborn in the family, you have to like dress them in red and then hide their, if you have like a home viewing of, you know, if the casket comes to the house and you do a home viewing there, you have to like put the baby under the casket. So that way they can't take the baby back to the spirit world. And so that's something that I kind of connected with. And I found myself in very specific moments connecting with things. And I'm like, okay, like this is something that like people who have those indigenous beliefs, you know, indigenous culture and those beliefs that come with it, I should say, will relate to. And at the same time, it's like, you know, you have the little cross, and it's just like, because you can't, that's also very much a part of identity, because it's, you know, the religion that was like thrust upon and literally beat into ancient people as a way to kind of assimilate and to civilize, quote unquote. And so there were those aspects of it. I'm just like, okay, well, like that cross is not going to help you, but my herbs and my belief of the ancestors and all of that, getting in touch with it, this is what's going to save you from this extra big bad evil.
Right, right. No, I think that's great. I think that's awesome that you can bring that perspective to this and this whole conversation, obviously, as we look at other indigenous horror, so to speak, which again is sort of similar in that way to discussions in horror noir and black horror, that really I mean, the history is the horror and the horror is the history, you know, the things that white people may build and write as a horror movie. It might be because they have not been subjected to such horror. You know, so again, overall, I mean, this is, I think it was, you know, an interesting watch just to get, you know, kind of start some of these ideas, you know, percolating in our heads as we continue to watch the films of this nature. You know, dear listener, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you know, if you just want to watch it because, you know, you're listening to the show and want context, you should.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to watch it because, you know, if you want to watch it because I told Joshua, I'm like, I think I was like, this is going to sound shady, but it's not. I'm like, watching this makes me think that we could also do one. Like we
could make a movie.
Like we could make a movie, and that is like really comforting. But at the same time, like you have to think about when people, when you're thinking about representation and, you know, representation matters, representation's important, there are people who are doing that work. It's just absolutely, they're not being well-funded. Yeah. They're not being given access to those. Not getting
that same opportunity. Yeah.
Exactly. You're not being given that same opportunity. And I'm very aware that I'm trying not to say this as to sound like, you know, oh, if we just gave them a bunch of money and, them acting classes, it would be better. Like, no, this, like, when you have these kinds of stories and you have the ability to create, sometimes you can go out and do it.
Right.
And then what deems it as a success, you know, because we live in, you know, cis white hegemonic patriarchal capitalist society.
Yes, bell hooks.
Yeah, like bell hooks. Since we live in that kind of society, it's like, okay, well, you know, if we, this is only a success if it is like, you know, a, by what standard, you know, by what kind of standard. And so, but yeah, so I definitely think people should watch it at least once to kind of get that feel for it. If anything, introduce you to these artists and these people who are making the films. But it should also serve as like inspiration where it's like, yeah, I can go do that. Like, why?
Absolutely.
Why should I wait for someone to tell the story of my people when I can go in and tell this story in a very interesting and different way? And I'm always looking at it, and I love when we talk about it on the show, when we get to watch movies that are like flipping a genre on its head or like flipping it a little bit. So yeah,
exactly. Playing with,
exactly. Like this is like a haunted house narrative, but it's also like, you know, it's not holy water and chanting and all that kind of stuff. It's like herbs and the wisdom of ancestors that's getting us through this.
Yeah, exactly. And that in losing that and forgetting it, you're really left unprotected. And so it's a, yeah, it's a good, again, a good conversation starter. So, we will be back in 2 weeks because we will be off next week for the Thanksgiving / Indigenous Solidarity harvest time holidays. Mm-hmm. But we'll be back in 2 weeks to discuss. So, you know, you can watch it now, Blood Quantum. And I do believe we're going to have a special guest on for that day, but I don't want to say right now. But I do believe there'll be three voices in your earballs. And to continue this conversation, and Blood Quantum, I actually think is a really fun, good movie. And I think that you'll enjoy it more, Joe, or not, maybe not enjoy it more. It's quite a interesting film, but I think it's going to be, I think it's going to lead to a really fun conversation.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm very excited.
Yeah. And so again, that was The Smudging 2016. It is on, I think it's on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime, yeah. With subscription.
Yes, right. But yes, it is available. So until we see you in 2 weeks, Joe, good night.
Joshua, good night. Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.